With shows like The Expanse, 12 Monkeys, and Westworld, television sci-fi is sneakily becoming one of TV's most highly regarded genres. And our script for today, The Courier, is just that, so don't move a muscle.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Unproduced Table Read here on the Popcorn Talk Network. Today we're reading an unbelievably exciting, tense, fast-paced sci-fi drama called The Courier by Maria Sten, and I'm so excited to dive into it. But before we do that, let me tell you a little bit about the show. This is a show where we read Hollywood's hottest unproduced features and pilots with a group of amazing trained actors and the writers, typically in studio with us for insightful Q&As. So we're so excited that you guys are here, and we're so happy to have you. Before we introduce our writer, Maria, I would like for my cast to introduce themselves today and what character they'll be playing.
Sure. My name is Andrew Guy, and I'll be reading Barlow, Kendrick, and Mr. Hank Jessup.
Hi, I'm Adrienne Snow, and I'll be reading for Gene.
Good morning. I am Mike Klonowski, reading Franklin and Christopher.
I am Haley O'Connor. I'm reading Nadia Parrish and Shway.
Hey, everybody. I'm Timothy Michael. I will be reading Tanner, Eli, George, Sullivan, Terry, and the Young Man.
Hey, guys. Roxy Stryer, and I'll be reading for Tim, Julie, Vanessa, Mira, Weinblatt, and Tony.
And then I didn't introduce myself yet, guys. My name is Jeff Graham. I'll be reading our action today, as I always do.
Happy birthday, Jeff.
Oh, thank you, guys. It is my birthday. I'm turning 21, so it's great.
Congratulations. What's in that mug? So yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I would also, of course, like to introduce our amazing writer for today. We are so lucky to have the incredibly gifted Maria Sten. Maria is one of those people who's like a little bit annoyingly talented. Like, in 2008, she won Miss Denmark.
Oh,
which is amazing. I mean, that's awesome. And she's also an actress. And like unnecessarily gracious, and obviously a very, very, very talented writer. This script was featured on the Blacklist, so we're just so excited. I hope that intro did you justice, but
absolutely, I'm humbled.
Well, good. We're so happy to have you. You must be Danish.
I am.
Okay, very cool.
I am Danish, yes.
I'm excited to dig in more into your bio as we get into our Q&A. But I would love for you to talk just a bit about this script. Maybe give us 1 or 2 minutes about the world we're entering, what's going on, and maybe just a bit of setup before we dive in.
Yeah. So we enter the world post-global warming apocalypse after a war between humans and aliens have sort of decimated the ecosystem. After the Dark Ones, the aliens has come to the Earth, and we decided to go to war against them because we thought they came to attack us. So we enter this, and this is a group of human survivors that have settled down within the tunnels of Hoover Dam. And they sort of just try their best to survive and sort of maintain civilization. So they've created their own sort of government in a way, and their own constitution, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then they're provided with the water from Lake Mead and the hydroelectric power plant that is within Hoover Dam now, which makes Hoover Dam 100% self-sustainable via the energy there. So they're kind of well taken care of. It's a great place to be if you're in this world, and that's why they also do everything they can to protect this safe haven that they have. So when this... I don't want to give too much away.
Outsider.
Yes, when this outsider enters their midst, it sort of becomes a debate, much like the current political climate.
Great. Well, the social undertones are so subtle, but also very present, so I will be excited to get into that. But
yes.
And I don't want to spoil anything for audience.
I know.
So I think we should go ahead and just dive right in. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being with us today here on the Unproduced Table Read. Today we're reading The Courier by Maria Sten, and we're going to get into it right now.
Woo!
Exterior desert ridge, early sunset. A low sun hangs above barren desert land, pushing its scorching mass towards the horizon. Sand, dust, heat. Stubborn bushes shimmer behind heat hazes in the valley below, eerily desolate. Heavy panting, crescendos, and wham! A hand shoots up from the edge of the cliff, white-knuckling the rock surface. A woman sporting an REI backpack from better days, hiking boots, and a tool belt, heaves herself onto the plateau, collapsing in the sand, gasping for air. She yanks away layers of rags, revealing her sunburned, disheveled face. Meet Nadia Parrish. Chapped lips, piercing brown eyes, sparkling with adrenaline. One of those people who makes thrill and peril hard to tell apart. She crawls to a puddle of water a few yards away and drinks vigorously from the shallow pit, until spotting a German shepherd collapsed at the end of the pit, dead. Murky waters swirl around the decaying flesh. Nadia shoves two fingers into her mouth and vomits. A quick wipe of the sleeve and back to work. She pulls a water bottle from her pack, holds it up, revealing Sharpie markers drawn down the side. 10 days. 5 days. 3 days. 1 day. And at the bottom, a tiny Sharpie skull, where the current water level mocks her calamity. Finito. Nadia falls back onto the ground, eye to eye with the dog. So fucked. A slurping noise makes her snap up. She looks to the water around her. Nothing. She drags the shepherd away from the water. He could be sleeping, but for his frail, decomposing body. From her pack, she pulls a leather-bound herbarium, leafing through pages of various plants and flower species, landing on a white lotus, dried in perfect shape. She sticks the lotus in a small heap of wet sand by the shepherd's head. Takes a moment for the fallen. Nadia's eyes wander to the distance. Against a flaming orange sunset, a cluster of shrubs breaks the horizon, framing a tall, familiar silhouette. A cactus. You can wait for death, or... She rises, throws on the backpack, face determined, stepping forward, and wham! Strange, unearthly sound vibrations disrupt the quiet as something grabs her legs. Splat! Nadia hits the ground, clutching at nothing as the something drags her swiftly backwards by the ankles, back over the edge of the cliff she'd just climbed. As her scream pierces through the air, we smash to black. Title sequence, The Courier. Interior residence room, the damn morning. Close on an empty glass bottle, upside down, the last drop of water creeping its way down the mouth of the bottle. Tilt down to Eli, freckled, wide-eyed, skin and bones, his tongue out, waiting for the drop to land. Drip. He lowers the bottle, sticks his finger in it, licks the finger. Eli is on the floor of a tiny room, gray concrete everywhere. A candlelit lantern casts just enough light to make out the modest interior. Bundles of blankets are draped around him. Pillow, comic books, a big wooden chest. For a 10-year-old boy's room, it's surprisingly neat. He rummages around in his pillowcase, searching. Nothing. He swallows hard. A sharp whistle blows in the distance. Eli jumps to his feet. Too fast. Vertigo. He sways, staggering to the door and yanks it open, entering into interior tunnel the damn same. He trots along dark, textured rock corridors, turns the corner. Watch it! Two militant athletic men in beige uniforms zoom past him in the opposite direction, competing to take the lead. Eli stops, gazing after them. The whistle blows twice, closer. He jumps, takes off again, turns another corner, passing under a row of poster-sized photo plaques hanging from the ceiling above. A burning oil rag. A mass grave. A group portrait of white American children with Kawish, help me out with that one, Maria.
Kwasi Okor.
An inscription underneath reads, Memento. Devastating black dust clouds, explosions not from any weapon made by man. And inscribed here, Mori. Old news to Eli. He's focused on the archway ahead, where a dozen teenagers scurry past each other, making up the rear. Eli hurries through the archway into interior classroom, the damn same. The teenagers find their seats. Eli, youngest of them all, scuffles to a chair. Next to him, Julie, 15, is already seated, notepad out. She's mousy, an introvert, with occasional and arguably obnoxious spunk.
Hurry, sit before Franklin calls you out.
The whistle blows loudly 3 times. As we land on the source, Franklin Reed stands in front of the congregation, a whistle between his teeth. He shoots Eli a look, though there's a hint of a smile in his eyes. The arch brow and a 5 o'clock shadow suggests Franklin is all lumberjack charm until he opens his mouth.
By now, you've all realized that the class begins on the third blow, and if you're not in your seats by then, you're late.
Chucking little 8-ounce water bottles to each of the students who eagerly catch them.
So when the first blow sounds, your adrenaline kicks in. Boom.
Chuck. Chuck.
Suddenly, a rush of energy through your body to counter fatigue.
Check.
Or boredom.
Chuck.
That will prevent you from learning. This whistle.
One sharp blow, the kids jump.
Lets me control you. This is the basic principle of classical conditioning, which is what we'll all be discussing today in relation to the human experience.
And forget Lumberjack. Now this is Socrates, with a face that belongs on the box of that overpriced cologne you recently bought. He sets the last bottle down in front of Eli. Next to him, Julie listens, eyes like Christmas lights.
This month's exercise were for you guys to experience the process of conditioning firsthand and how we might come to understand it better before we fall victim to it in the future.
Just then, Barlow, 16, brawny, sporting an attitude of everything adolescent, walks in and takes the last open seat on the other side of Eli. Franklin looks at Barlow, then continues ignoring him.
George, when the whistle blew once, what was your first thing you wanted?
George, 14, pudgy, curious but shy, answers.
To get to class?
Why?
George, wondering if it's a trick question.
Because I didn't want to be late.
And when you got here on time and settled into your seat, how did that make you feel?
Good. I felt good.
And that would be the endorphin release that happens when you feel excitement.
Franklin turns to write the word conditioning on a smooth concrete wall, doubling as a makeshift blackboard. And Barlow sees an opportunity to snatch Eli's water bottle quickly and discreetly. Eli fumbles for it, but Barlow pulls a dagger from the leather sheath on his belt. A clear warning. Eli recoils. Franklin, back still turned, misses it, and no one's ratting out Barlow.
I know you're all ecstatic about class every morning, but the endorphin rush is triggered by the feeling of victory. It's small, but it's something, right?
George nods, smiles nervously.
And Barlow, what did you feel this morning?
Water bottle gone, privately etching the bottle on the table with his dagger, Barlow stops and looks up.
Hungry.
Yes, now that would be the canine response in conditioning theory, people. Remember that one.
Franklin and Doris chuckles for everyone, but Barlow.
I didn't get to eat.
Well, rations were allotted yesterday.
I'd rather die than see one more of those can of beans.
Are you sure about that?
Barlow stares.
Conditioning, Barlow. Means to train or accustom someone to have to behave in a particular way. Training yourself to only accept what you want, not what you need, is not a condition you're going to be able to sustain. The solution you think is the easy one, you may actually be the one to kill you, because you haven't been prepared for the consequences.
I'm prepared for anything.
Are you prepared to die?
Quiet.
I suggest you eat when served.
Franklin reaches into the drawer, retrieving a small bag, then tosses it across the room. Barlow catches the almonds. Eli glares at Barlow. Water and food. Life can be an old mean bitch.
You're all familiar with the term instant gratification. How did this condition develop, and how did it play a part in Earth War?
Interior turbine hall, the dam, same. Massive concrete walls line a long hall, supporting a 100-foot ceiling. Eight gigantic cylinder-shaped spinning tops are spaced evenly through the length of the hall. Water turbines. At the nearest turbine, turbine number one, a man sits hunched at the bottom, welding a pipe. Tanner, 32, is a handyman, tech nerd, amateur inventor galore guy. The churning and crunching echoes through the hall as a woman approaches him, covered by the noise he doesn't notice until she's right behind him. He jumps, sparks fly from the welding machine.
Heads up.
Are you trying to kill me?
Oh, you know I'd be quicker than that.
She says it just a little too straight face. Tanner shakes his head.
That's not funny.
Death never is.
This is Jean, 30s, steely, type A poster child. Would be warm and nurturing if she could just remember how. Tanner looks at her, dark circles around her eyes, dim an otherwise soft and beautiful face.
When was the last time you've been outside?
Sound like Franklin.
Thank you.
She gives him a look.
I'm just saying, sometimes lack of vitamin D can affect a person's mood and demeanor, and you look like you haven't slept for a century.
Thanks, Tanner.
I mean, that's not what I meant. I just mean you could maybe
check in to see how you're doing with a desalinator. That is funny. I was just thinking that.
Knee slapper.
How's it looking?
Not good, I'm afraid. I've tried fusing the leak, but the air pressure keeps blowing it open. Without turbine one, we can't produce enough energy for all the dam's power sources and boil the desalinator water.
As he talks, Jean looks up to the wall.
It'll take 18 hours on full boil to process all the seawater we have in storage right now.
Where three large barometers hang above the turbines, an indicator marking each of their statuses lists reserve tank yellow zone, low. Dam, red zone, critical. Desalinator, green zone, normal.
So we'll have to use the reserve tank.
If I can't get this fixed today, by today, yes.
And the proxy water?
Still in demineralization. It needs at least three more circulations before all the alien goo is filtered away.
We have to use the reserve for more than 2 days.
Leaving that prospect hanging, Tanner stews for a moment, then.
I can only think of one other option. We go on reserve tank for 1 day, and if I don't have this one up, been running by then, we cut the residents' power sources.
Go dark.
Just for 18 hours, while the desalinator does its thing.
No power grid, no intercom, no radar.
No water.
Interior classroom, a little later. While we were gone, Franklin has chalked more notes on his blackboard. Conditioning, greed, gluttony versus survival instincts, fight or flight.
So our greed and gluttony, the pillars of instant gratification, also impacted the ecosystem. How?
Global warming?
Yes. The environment was already on the brink of disaster before Earth War began.
But you think we could have saved the environment if Earth War hadn't happened?
George takes notes. Eli stares at Barlow, pops one almond after another into his mouth.
It's hard to say. Regardless, we'll never know. The important thing is not to dwell on things we cannot change, but to keep looking forward.
It's a little too intense for just the ecosystem. This is more personal than that.
To keep getting better. To fix what our parents' generation could not.
And Julie's sympathetic look at him supports that theory. Over to Eli, some dark memories triggered in his mind.
You mean you?
Everyone looks to Barlow.
Fix what your generation couldn't.
and we glimpse it. Behind all that bitterness, there's an 18-wheeler of pain. Franklin locks eyes with Barlow, deciding on a response. Before we can answer...
If the Dark Ones came to kill us, why didn't they just kill us? Why'd they go for our oil rigs and gas plants and all that first?
Peeling his eyes off Barlow...
There are theories, but we still don't know the answer to that.
Beat, Franklin sets his jaw.
We do, however, know how the Patronus platform was destroyed and triggered the explosion.
Franklin waits, but not even Julie knows where this is going.
Today's thesis maintains that before the exposure, we were conditioned to instant gratification.
He points to Barlow's half-eaten bag of almonds.
Solutions with quick results, without concern for the long-term repercussions. If I have something of great value, and I know you're going to take it from me, what's the quickest way to avoid that?
You destroy it.
When you're fighting a war for humanity, and you realize that you're going to lose, what then is the quickest way to avoid giving the Dark Ones access to everything you love?
Everything up in flames.
Quiet and usually timid Eli doesn't miss a beat. This is the life he knows. Franklin locks in on him.
When self-preservation becomes self-destruction.
Exterior desert day. Swoosh! A dagger soars through the air. Funk! It lands bullseye in a prickly pear cactus. Reveal Kendrick, early 30s, tall, black, body like Captain America. Authoritative. It's clearly his dagger.
I've got fruit bowl.
He moves towards the cactus, a few feet away. Tim, 20s, a lanky, blue-eyed, happy-go-lucky white dude.
Man, I'm sick of prickly pears.
Christopher, 50, practical, MacGyver finesse, but very ordinary injects.
Eat 12 more days of beans.
Amen.
Wearing gloves, Kendrick expertly flays the cactus meat with his dagger and takes a bite of the slimy cactus meat. Pleased. He looks to the last member of the group, Shui, a short and skinny Asian girl whose eyes are scanning the perimeter, her samurai sword flexed at the ready.
Hey, Shui, you want some?
Not hungry.
Kendrick underhands the cactus over to her anyway. Shui reacts by swiftly swinging her sword at the cactus, slicing it in half midway through the air. Zing! Plunk, plunk, the cactus halves land in the sand.
Sandy prickly pear, for real, man.
You, eat.
Thanks.
But Tim does not pick up the pieces. But Tim does pick up the pieces, handing one to Christopher. They brush off the sand and eat. Kendrick shakes his head, then quickly preps the rest of the cactus plant and stores it in his backpack. All four of them carry sturdy backpacks, wear combat boots and hooded beige uniforms of hemp fabric. Daggers and tracking gear adorn their belts, all indicating this is the group of hunters, the dam's infamous combat ranger unit.
How much water do we need to find?
5 gallons.
Shit, boss lady up the quota.
You know women need things.
Tim grins, Shui flexes her sword. Kendrick's lip twitches.
We're using more than we have. The suicides help, but the dam is getting crowded.
Yeah, can't be left alone anywhere.
Kendrick clocks the snub, but banter is over. It's back to business, and he's in charge.
More people, more water. We loop the eastern trail and veer off towards Mesa Crest. Then call it for today.
The team share a look at the name, Mesa Crest.
Gotta get this ration distributed by tomorrow. Get your lollipops and stay strapped.
They produce octagon plastic devices from their gear and put them in their mouths. The lollipops, a.k.a. gas masks. The team edges skillfully into formation, moving silently, weapons at hand, eyes alert on the perimeter. No fucking around with these peeps. As they advance... Interior situation room, the damn day. More concrete, no windows. Some electric wiring, an old desktop computer hums. One light bulb illuminates the room. Gene stands in front of a huge board full of pinned photos. Black dust cloud explosions. Some as on the plaque Eli saw in the tunnel. A black and fiery mushroom cloud, massive. A fisherman sits in a treetop just above ocean level next to the Sequoia National Park sign. Newspaper article headlines can be spotted. Record 180 degrees in Mexico City, thousands dead. Seattle Reservoir, empty. Where do we go now? Goodbye, Greenland, the end of permafrost. New York City, the new Atlantis. The doors open behind her, revealing Sergeant Hank Jessup III, 50s, narrow eyes, robust, dressed in the same beige uniform as our hunters. He may as well have had U.S. Army tattooed across his forehead, but makes do with the old dog tags around his neck. Joining Gene by the wall.
Past the classroom coming up. He's teaching them about Petronius, Gene.
Gene looks over, brows creasing deeper. A beat. She turns back to the wall.
Telling the kids all about how we drop nukes on ourselves doesn't exactly promote faith in the system, you think?
Franklin believes knowing the why can change the how. And right now, we've got bigger things to worry about.
Her eyes are focused on a large dam in the middle of the board, covering Hoover Dam, Las Vegas, Grand Canyon, and the new ocean shoreline, the Sierra Nevada Mountains.
We're already allotting smaller rations. I need more water and more dry foods. How far is the team going?
Ah, boss lady.
They're on the Eastern Trail and are going to push farther out in the canyon here. Going to try hunting for water there without getting too exposed.
He's pointing to a trail and a mark on the map as he speaks.
By Mesa Crest? The toxicity level there is above moderate.
It's the Alpha Team. They know what they're doing.
It's not like there's much choice. Turbine 1's still down.
Proxy water's better than no water.
Gene's face says something different.
The more aliens we tap, the less there'll be left.
Right. Well, let's keep working on the ocean trail so it's mapped when the desalinator is up and running again. We'll send another team soon as the office gets back.
Jessup is about ready to answer when an emergency alarm pierces through the speaker system.
Alert, intruder approach. Alert, intruder approach.
Beat, Gene, beat. Gene and Jessup look up at each other. Things move fast. Gene snatches the map off the wall, folds it into a secret drawer, locks the drawer with the key hanging from her neck. Jessup opens the drawer and grabs two assault rifles.
No guns.
What? Gene, we haven't had an intruder in months. Who knows what it can be?
No guns in the dam. They stay outside. Get rid of those.
Is that an order?
No time for bullshit. She grabs two walkie-talkies from a shelf, holds one up to Jessup, waiting. Jessup, knowing his priorities, finally locks the rifles away and snatches a walkie. Interior tunnel same. Gene and Jessup power walk along rocky corridors. Gene holds up her walkie.
What do we got, Tony?
The woman's voice from the speaker continues to crackle through.
A traveler in the bed, solo. Don't know how he got so close. The radar didn't pick him up.
Any
sign of alien activity?
Not as far as I can tell. He must be out of it. Was walking in circles.
Tony, get the guards up for overwatch.
Already up, sir. Four rifles on the towers, two on the cliffs.
Good. Tell the tower guards to keep him at gunpoint till we have him in custody.
A look from Jane.
Selvin and Vanessa will move in for extraction.
Yes, sir.
That's a go. We'll approach from the deck.
Copy that. Switching to Hunter channel now. Over and out.
No one fires unless ordered to.
They know the command, but if it's an ambush, we'll want those snipers on the cliffs.
They turn a corner, approaching two massive double doors, and bump into...
You have snipers out already? You don't even know who's out there.
Exactly.
It could be alien.
Gene, there's zero proof of aliens ever engaging humans.
Right. They hide and wait for us to come to them. So, we come prepared.
Gene smashes the doors open, bracing herself for a stream of hard sunlight as she walks out. Not much for sun, it seems. Franklin and Jessup follow. Exterior observation deck, the damn day. We tail them through the doors, swoop out over the deck along its railing, tracking Gene towards the end of the deck, framed against the backdrop of a red rock mountain wall. Franklin and Jessup catch up, all three of them standing at the railing looking down upon exterior dry lake bed day, as we soar wide to reveal the Hoover Dam in all its post-global warming apocalypse glory. Solar panels cover the entire face of the actual dam wall. Four Hunter snipers are perched on each of the dam's four water towers. The mouth of the dam, bone dry from the lack of flowing water, is now a dry lake bed where Hunters, Selvin and Vanessa, in beige uniforms with assault rifles, reach a collapsed figure in the middle of the, quote, dam bed.
Human target confirmed. Moving to contact.
Selvin moves in, Vanessa automatically on his 3 o'clock. Their similar features and instinctual synchronized movement suggest they're brother and sisters.
Checking for vitals.
Vanessa's on high alert, her rifle aimed at the target. On the deck.
Is he alive?
It's not a he.
You said it was a human.
Circling down at the dam bed party, close on Selvin, turning the person over, revealing Nadia Parrish. It's the desert traveler with the herbarium.
It's a woman.
On the deck.
Go for extraction.
Back to Selvin and Vanessa move in together as they forcefully grab Nadia, dragging her body towards the dam structure. Interior tunnel of the dam a few moments later. Selvin and Vanessa, now stands rifles, drag the lifeless Nadia through the corridors.
Damn, she's heavy.
Get every up your push-ups, Mary Gunn.
Oh, shut it.
No one notices the liquid trail dribbling from Nadia's limbs and legs. Interior stairway tunnel, the dam same. Gene, Jessup, and Franklin descend the stone steps.
I'd like to know how the hell our security system missed that woman.
I'll ask Tanner about any electrical outages.
I'll have the hunters prep for execution. The east side wall was just cleared.
Wait, look. Apathy and aggression towards every stranger that comes through here won't continue to benefit us in the long run. More and more our people are showing signs of either depression or violence. And
not the time for psychoanthropological thesis.
That's not where I'm going.
So give me the short version.
Food and resources are depleting. Enter panic, then fear. The scourge of hunger will drive our relations towards unsolidarity.
Franklin.
You want to overrule the public? I didn't see that coming.
They've stopped outside two metal doors. A massive church bell hangs from the rock wall, separating the doors.
Not overrule. Sway. Intruders represent life on the outside. If we keep rejecting that, then there is a world there that if we keep rejecting that there is a world there to rebuild, our people will lose hope. Next thing, you have four people lying dead at the foot of the dam. Daily suicides don't exactly promote faith in the system.
They had free will, and they made their free choice.
Gene yanks on the bell rope, ending that discussion. It echoes throughout the entire dam's tunnel system, foreboding and thrilling.
Don't prep the execution yet. We stick to protocol. The rolling will decide.
Off Franklin.
The people will decide. Your words. With rations getting smaller, we have to maintain status quo.
You're the boss.
Their eyes lock. She takes off through the door on the right.
We can never obtain peace in the outer world until we make peace between ourselves.
With ourselves, Hank. Maybe ease in on the Dalai Lama, yeah?
As he walks off the door to the left, a sourpuss Jessup follows. Interior, Colosseum, the dam, same. 300 square feet of sand and gray concrete. A cold factory light hangs from the low ceiling. An aluminum table sits alone in the center, flanked by two chairs. Gene walks to the front of the room, where a low concrete barrier sections this part off of the space from the viewing lodge, same. Twice as large, with rows of chairs, all facing the Colosseum. Franklin and Jessup take the front row. From an entryway in the back, residents of the dam mill in to find seats. A pale, haggard, ethnically diverse group of people, mostly the hardy working-class kind. Thick-skinned, unpolished, underprivileged survivors. A handful of sunburned faces in the crowd stand out, emphasized by their signature beige hemp uniforms, hunters. Franklin's students, Julie, Eli, George, and Barlow amongst them, race for their own section in the back, excited. Oh, dearest childhood. The excitement spreads through the crowd, like settling in for a good Mayweather fight. Blood is in the air. Interior Coliseum viewing lodge intercut. Selvin and Vanessa drag Nadia in, setting her down in the chair facing the audience. She slumps over the table. In the lodge, Terry, 40s, mustache and flannel, and Weinblatt, 40s, Jewish and graying, offer their own colorful commentary, both of them about as crass as cardboard.
I don't know why they still bother going through the motions when we know how it's going to end.
Why, interrupting your busy schedule of Jenga and masturbation?
Order in the hole.
Jessup sits. Franklin stands, some eyeballing them.
To and for the community and the citizens of the United States of America, we invoke the 29th Amendment and our right to protect ourselves from all hostile elements and species from the Earth, on the Earth, by any means necessary.
Terry mouths along to this spiel somewhat callously.
To preserve the peace and to maintain a democratic republic, let us rule.
Let us rule.
Franklin sits, looks to Jean, who turns to take her seat opposite that the bundle that is Nadia, and nods to Selvin and Vanessa, who are still standing guard. Vanessa pulls a plastic stick from her belt. Zzzzet! Electricity crackles from the taser.
Ah!
Off Nadia, most definitely still alive. Interior turbine hall, same.
Ah!
Tanner, occupied with more pressing matters than rulings, welds away on the turbine pipe with a small piece of metal. When a small piece of metal shoots out from the spark, slicing his hand.
Ouch, damn it.
He gets up, examining his hand. A gash is formed. Blood is coming.
Oh, no.
He hurries off along the turbines.
Waste of blood.
Drip, drip, leaving a trail of blood behind. Interior Coliseum viewing lodge intercut. Nadia moans in pain. Vanessa retracts the taser and retreats to the back wall next to her brother. Nadia stirs and slowly raises her hand, barely functioning.
State your name.
Nadia.
Last name?
Parrish.
Where are you traveling from?
Close on Nadia.
Hell.
Gene doesn't miss a beat.
And where exactly is that, Nadia?
I'm from Lake Tahoe Refugee Village.
Well, as far as I know, that's a functional community with open fresh water.
Tahoe's almost dry. People are fighting over the last remaining water holes.
Damn. Some, it can't be true, and oh my gods, among the spectators.
The last communication with the Tahoe Village suggested that they would outlast Lake Mead.
So it's eat or be eaten up there. Guess we can accept more visitors soon.
Neither likes the sound of that.
How did you get here?
I walked.
Shit, that's over 400 miles.
Bit of stamina on that one.
How did you survive this journey?
I don't know.
And what were your resources? A guide? Supplies?
Nadia is struggling, sapped of energy.
No, I'm saying I don't remember.
Did you travel alone?
Selvin and Vanessa squeeze the hands of their daggers, the way certain cops rest their hands on their gun holsters.
I'm not here to hurt anyone.
We don't know who you are, Nadia Parrish, or why you are here. So I suggest you start remembering, because until you've convinced us otherwise, you're as good as a dark one here.
Exterior desert day. The four Alpha Team members run swiftly, one after another, on a narrow trail across wide desert land. Shuey's at the end, keeping stride, despite her smaller physique. Even ordinary Christopher looks like a triathlon runner. They're vigilant, exhilarated. To some folks, freedom is worth the price of danger. Kendrick signals to stop. They pull out their gas mask mouthpieces to catch their breaths, checking their gear. Kendrick scans the horizon. Suddenly, he stops. Dark dust clouds converging swiftly. They start to resolve, forming some kind of tornado, pushing towards a ridge in the distance. Just then, his tracking device starts blinking red. Kendrick looks to Christopher, who has the other device. Sure enough, red flashes on the small monitor. Incessantly. A beat.
I count five.
And me too.
Five?
Looks like a congregation of sorts.
Since when do they go together?
We're about to find out. That's Mesa Crest Ridge.
The 5 gallons of proxy water waiting.
He pulls a black square cloth from his backpack and tucks it in his belt for easy reach.
This is recon only for now. Do not engage unless I give the order.
Copy that.
Both Tim and Shui look disappointed, but...
Copy.
Kendrick signals to move, and they're off. Interior call, see him later. Further into the interrogation, Jean presses on.
So where did you find water on the way?
I desalinated from the Pacific down through Sierra Nevada, then rationed when I hit the desert.
In the lodge, with our teenagers in the back, Barlow is eyeing the hunters in the audience, and Julie is eying Barlow, smirking at his poorly hidden adoration.
Why did you leave the Pacific if you had desalination tools?
George is paying full attention to the proceedings.
I was looking for places with real fresh water, certain plants.
But no proxy water?
Eli is sweating bullets, struggling to keep himself straight. Off his eyes, focusing, unfocusing.
I don't drink alien, and I saw no alien coming here.
That you remember.
I remember the desert.
So how did you find the dam?
I told you, I don't know. Maybe I had heat stroke. I was in the desert. I found a dog. That's the last thing I remember.
It's not helping you much.
Nadia looks at her audience, then back at Jean. Off Nadia, slowly realizing she's losing this battle.
I'm just a person. Why are you so afraid of me?
We have to protect ourselves from...
Suddenly, a disturbance in the back.
He's not breathing!
Somebody help him!
Everybody turns. Eli's on the floor, convulsing, still sweating, pale as ice. A docile-looking young man holds him steady.
Breathe, Eli. Come on.
Jean rises. Selvin and Vanessa are at the table in a flash, grabbing Nadia's shoulders. As Jean jumps the barrier, Jessup takes her place in the Colosseum, his arrow and eyes locked on Nadia.
What's wrong with him?
He just fell down and started shaking. I don't know what happened.
Franklin rushes over, puts two fingers on Eli's neck.
His pulse is out of control and his temperature's spiking. We need a doc.
Won't make it here in time.
Franklin pulls up Eli, carries him to the Colosseum, and puts him on the interrogation table.
Get Mira now.
Selvin obeys and exits. Jean looks to Franklin. They're both uncharacteristically rattled. Jessup looks up at Eli.
He needs CPR.
Nadia is still constrained in her seat directly in front of Eli.
He needs a relaxant. Let me help him.
You're not touching him.
I can help. If he doesn't come out of that seizure soon, he could die. Let me help him.
Jean chews her lip. Eli is still convulsing, and finally...
He dies, you die.
Nadia grabs her pack from the corner, Vanessa trailing her every move. She rummages through the pack, grabs a tiny drawstring leather purse, and empties the powdery content in her hand. Shoves the dried brown powder into Eli's mouth, trying to get him to keep it in.
I need some water.
People look around, no one moves.
Can no one spare the kid some fucking water?
Finally, little George comes forward and climbs the barrier to hand an 8-ounce bottle.
Thank you.
Off George, in the back of the lodge, Barlow slowly backs away towards the back exit. In the Colosseum, Nadia pours the water back down, water into Eli's mouth.
Come on, swallow. Swallow. Come on, kid, get it down.
Eventually, Eli does. 5 long seconds. Then Eli takes a deep gasp of air and finally stops convulsing. Off Franklin's eyes, pinned on Jean, who breathes a sigh of relief. The door swings open and in walks Selvin with Mira, 60, Indian, calm demeanor like honey.
What'd you give him?
Cat's claw. It's an herb.
Mira crosses to the table and inspects Eli.
Hard to come by around these parts. It dilates the blood vessels so the blood pressure can come back down.
If you're that lucky.
Looks like you were.
Mira smiles at Nadia, the first person to do so. Then Mira takes out a glass vial with some kind of smelling salt and uncorks it under Eli's nose. He comes to it. Selvin and Vanessa grab Nadia again, pushing her back to the seat.
I'll get him taken care of.
She heads towards the door. The docile young man from earlier carries Eli up behind her. Jean watches them go and looks to Jessup, having followed Nadia's every move. His eyes move to meet Jean's. A look of silent skepticism speaks volumes. Jean pulls out her walkie. Interior turbine hall, operations office day. Tanner walks past unmanned desks overflowing with paperwork, electronic gadgets, and disconnected wires going everywhere, measuring beakers half full of various forms of liquid. His radio crackles.
Tanner, has there been any trouble with our radar system within the last 2 days?
It goes scratchy at night without the solar board, but nothing out of the ordinary. Is this about the intruder alarm?
He reaches the back wall that holds a smaller version of the Situation Room's board. A map, pamphlet manuals on desert framing, irrigation, food dehydration, solar desalination.
A migrant woman appeared in the damned bed, supposedly from Lake Tahoe Village, trying to confirm if she came alone.
He reaches for a shelf, grabbing an old first aid kit, searching for leftover gauze. There's none.
Well, Tony would most definitely have told me if the radar was malfunctioning, but I'll recheck the wiring tomorrow.
Did you get the turbine fixed yet?
Still working on it. Hit a minor bump in the road.
Do I need to come over there?
No. No, everything is fine. Under control. It's just a little more slippery than I thought it'd be.
Keep me informed.
Yes, boss.
Click. He swears under his breath, holding out his bleeding hand, walks between the desks in search of a hearty solution. As he pauses over the table with liquids, a drop of blood falls from his hand into a beaker containing something that looks like black oil mixed with clear water.
Shit, not that one.
Rough day for Tanner. He sees his blood dissolve in the liquid, colorfully spreading through the black oily parts. Huh. Slowly, that look on Tanner's face appears. An idea. Interior Coliseum viewing lodge same. Jean is sitting at a table opposite Nadia again. The two women study each other.
That was quite a show. Where did you learn that?
I'm a botanist.
You're saying that now?
You didn't give me a chance.
I think you're looking for work in the wrong region.
A horticultural botanist.
George in the back of the viewing lodge.
What's that?
Gardening, making things grow.
Unaware of them, Nadia adds,
I came south to research crop cultivation. I was collecting drought-tolerant plants, hoping to find a way to mutate their genetic makeup to be both drought-tolerant and nutritiously diverse.
Franklin, looking like Christmas came early, to Jean.
Any luck?
Not yet. Succulent plants seem to be the most flexible, but there's still no significant variable in its nutritional benefit.
So if you did not invent a new fruit that sustained you on a 400-mile trek through the desert, what did?
A bee. Nadia's fed up. She takes a deep breath, steadying herself.
When I was 9, I went on a hiking trip with my family up near Mount Whitney, and I got lost. I spent 15 hours climbing through the snow. 7 degrees. Pitch darkness. Then I found this pile of frozen cougar feces, and I used it to dig out a ditch so I could climb in there to keep out of the wind. It was 3 degrees away from renal failure when they found me. You know what my mom said when I woke up at the hospital?
You didn't answer my question.
Adapt and overcome. Nature has shown me time and again that it does not adapt to us. And if we don't evolve and adapt to nature, it revolts against us. That's how I survived. Adapting. Evolving. From a pile of cat shit. And that's my wish for the future of humanity before we all end up dead.
A beat.
Let's proceed to the ruling.
Off Nadia, once again, faced with the prospect of death, Jean stands and turns to the crowd.
All those in favor of asylum for Nadia Parrish, vote now.
Approximately half the crowd stands up, holding out their arms and give a thumbs up. Franklin, George, and Julie among them. Jessup counts the crowd.
16.
All those opposed to asylum for Nadia Parrish, vote now.
The other half, including Jessup, stand up to show thumbs down. Again, he counts.
16.
It's Jean's vote. She looks to Franklin and Jessup, her right-hand man number one and number two at odds. Gotta love democracy. She finally extends her arms to cast the deciding vote. Thumbs up.
Ain't that some shit?
Asylum has been granted. The ruling is done.
The crowd exits, some disappointed. Jean stands immovable, watching them. Franklin walks up to her, about to say something when...
Evolve or perish. That's our options. Better get started.
As Franklin exits, quiet. Selvin and Vanessa follow, Nadia between them. Jessup approaches Jean.
Watch out for that one. Something doesn't add up.
Off Jean. Interior turbine hall same. Tanner approaches a big container tank near the far end of the hall. A sign reads, Proxy Water. Warning, alien waste. He bends down to the pouring spout looking closely. Some black liquid residue sits in the rim of the spout. Tanner pushes a lever, allowing a black mercury-like slimy consistency to pour onto the water in his beaker. Like Balasmico hitting olive oil just made from aliens. Satisfied with this, he gets up to leave. Exterior residence room later. Franklin, Selvin, Vanessa, and Nadia stop in front of a door.
All yours, boss.
Thanks, V.
With one last look, Vanessa and Selvin walk off. Nadia glares after Vanessa. Franklin moves past her into interior residence room, same. A concrete room similar to Eli's. The bare essentials a la a prison cell. Two single cots hug a wall, each. A nightstand, lantern, modest functionality. He gestures for her to enter.
This is you.
She takes in the room. The cot squeaks heavily as she sits, feeling it all out. To her, it's pretty much heaven.
You'll eventually have a roommate, but I doubt it'll be anytime soon.
Franklin stands in the door studying her. She looks up.
A horticultural botanist.
That's the one.
It appears nature saved your life today.
Wouldn't be the first time.
He acknowledges, then turns to leave.
Hey, Mr.
Franklin.
Thank you, Franklin.
Welcome to the dam.
He exits. Nadia lays down on the cot and sighs, the longest day of her life finally over. Exterior Mesa Crest Ridge afternoon. Our alpha team ascend the steep slope of a mountain ridge. Kendrick and Tim have their daggers wedged between their teeth, true pirate form. Shuey boulders ahead, her blade slung across her back. Christopher launches forward with only one hand, his left holding the tracking device. They climb in silence. As they close in on the top, sounds echo down from above. Deep, roaring bass vibrations pulsating like a jet engine. Bursts of electromagnetic crackling pops every few seconds. Kendrick signals to stop. They're just about to blow the top rim.
What the fuck is that?
Off all of them wondering what the fuck that is.
Communication?
Kendrick signals again. They spread out for cover among the edge of the plateau, just out of sight. Dust and sand rain down from them from the mysterious mayhem above. They ready their weapons and hold as Kendrick slowly inches upwards, peeking over the edge. His body stiffens. Off his alarmed expression, exterior Mesa Crest Ridge above, same. Slowly pushing forward, we see dark shadows on the sand, moving here and there at lightning speed, matching the wild, unearthly sounds. Occasionally, the shadow of a long, thick rope-like arm whips out of the dark mass, causing a black, mercury-like, slimy matter to land in the sand, slither around, resemble, split apart, and reform again. Exterior, Mesa Crest Ridge, below, same. Christopher checks his tracker, signals to Kendrick, 4. Kendrick checks, same. Tim, 1 for each. Shui raises her sword. Off Kendrick, the kind of man most likely to go hand-to-hand with a mountain lion on any given Tuesday, hesitating, cut to black. Exterior, the dam, late afternoon, establishing. Extreme wide. Hunter guards standing watch. 2 on the Nevada Towers, 2 on the Arizona Towers. The guard on the Arizona North Tower looks upon the basin, revealing a nearly empty reservoir. Rock formations protrude from the bottom, breaking the water's surface. The rock wall's distinct color change reminds everyone where the water once stood. Interior healing room, the dam. Late afternoon. An aluminum table. A wooden chest of drawers. Its shelves lined with glass vials, bottles, herbs, gauze, and other medicinal paraphernalia. In the corner, Mira is bent over a cot, tending to Eli. He's pale and clammy, but fully conscious when Jean enters. Mira backs away and lets Jean sit down next to him.
You gave us quite a scare there, Eli. Do you know why you got sick?
What's going to happen to that woman?
Well, let's worry about you first. Can you think of any reason why you got sick?
I'm out of water.
Well, we gave refills 5 days ago. Have you not been rationing?
It was stolen.
Your water? By who?
Eli's quiet. If he does know, he ain't saying. Jean's tone changes.
Eli, who stole your water?
I don't want any more people to die. What's going to happen to that woman? Is she going to die too? Is everyone just going to die?
Unexpectedly, Jean's demeanor melts. Maternal instinct triggered.
No one's going to die today, honey. I know you miss your mom and dad, but they're still with you, you know? They see how strong you are.
They can't see anything when they're dead.
Mira stands in the background, watching them.
Well, it takes a lot of courage to hope. Today, 2 people didn't die. 2 people were saved. I think that's worth a little hope, don't you? Everything is going to be fine. We're all going to be fine.
She strokes his cheek, rubbing away a freckle, impersonating Smudge.
Get some rest.
He lies back on the cot. Mira and Jean move towards the table. Mira goes to the shelves and reaches for a glass jar.
Rough day to death.
Behind which, a small glass vial with brown liquid sits hidden. She takes the vial and sets it down in front of Jean, who tries not to look at it.
I don't want it.
Mira smiles and shrugs, reaching for the vial. Jean stops her, a craving flashing across her eyes. Reluctantly, she pulls an 8-ounce water bottle from her jacket pocket and trades it for the brown liquid. Mira looks at her sympathetically.
Courage, dear. Everything is going to be fine.
And takes the water bottle. With one last look, Jean exits, off Mira placing the bottle in the drawer, stock full of those 8-ounce water bottles. Interior, Tanner's residence room, the damn late afternoon. Tanner enters. His room is messier, full of knickknacks and books, and the second cot occupied by Tanner's roommate. Masturbation in full swing.
Oh, dude!
Sorry, man. Thought you'd be gone all day.
Well, I gashed my hand and I had nothing to stop the bleeding, so I...
Dude, I really don't need to hear another idea involving anyone's blood. Just don't spill this time.
Everything's under control.
Cool beans. I'm a nap. He rolls over on his side, away from Tanner. Charming guy. I don't know why I cast myself as that. Tanner sets the beaker on his nightstand. He drags a box out from under the table and pulls out a microscope. As he sets up the microscope, the black mercury, water, and blood drop concoctions start to swirl. Close on the three textures, blending, splitting apart, blending again. Exterior Mesa Chris Ridge, below. Dusk. Our alphas are still tucked below the ridge, observing the aliens, the bass vibrations and crackling roar above them. Our team confers under the noise.
Or Darkies won Harvest. Not even Jessup's got that record.
This is new behavior. We don't know what reaction it'll present.
Could be a form of mind synchronization, energy expansion.
Man, we're in perfect ambush position. We can take each one, and you said we need 5 gallons of water.
Not if it means sending you to die.
Tim shuts it. That's the tone of Kendrick, Pole, and Rank. Kendrick looks to Shui, half expecting a rebuttal from her, too, but...
Your command, boss.
Christopher's quiet, studying Kendrick. If he's got anything to say, he ain't offering it. Kendrick deliberates. As the alien sounds slowly crescendo, he decides...
First break in this tornado thing, we engage. They don't break formation, we do not engage. Copy?
Copy.
Yes, sir.
And just as they turn their attention back to the Dark Ones, the vibrations peak and boom! The earth shakes with the deafening boom as the alien shadows obscure the plateau. A sea of sand, water, and black mercury spews everywhere, then suddenly, dead silence, a beat.
What the fuck just happened?
They wait 5 seconds as the dust settles. Nothing. Dead quiet.
Move in.
They climb onto exterior Mesa Crest Ridge above, same. The plateau, finding it deserted, but for a huge heap of sand next to a puddle of water. Adrenaline spiked, the Alpha Hunters advance. Interior, tunnel, the dam, dusk. Ding! Jean enters an elevator. Doors close, just missing the ding. The opposite elevator lands on this floor and the doors open. Franklin exits and heads down the tunnel, none the wiser. Interior, healing room, same. Franklin finds Mira tidying up her row of glass bottles.
You just missed her.
Did you give her anything?
Mira smiles.
You guys are so much alike. You want to be responsible for everyone.
Someone has to. Did you give her anything?
I simply do as the lady in command commands. We have to pick our battles. If you want information, just ask her yourself.
She smiles, innocent. He glares. Mira is well informed. Too well informed.
I have to get my analysis underway.
He exits. Mira looks after him with the same sympathetic look of concern she gave Jean. Exterior, the dam night establishing. The outline of the four tower guards silhouetted against the moonlight. Exterior, the dam. West side sidewalk, same. Jean walks along a high rock wall, past a row of dead palm trees, now functioning as the dagger-throwing targets. Selvin, Vanessa, and three other hunters stand opposite the massive trunks. Funk, funk, funk. Jean flinches infinitesimally with each dagger's penetrating thud in the dry wood.
Everything good, boss?
Jean shoots her a thumbs up, passing without slowing down. Vanessa's brows furrow, watching Jean walk away. Again with sympathy.
Hey, hungry eyes, you're up.
Hey, bro, talk about eyes when you throw like you got a pair.
She rejoins them, flips her dagger and aims. Exterior of the Dan Bridge, Angel's Plaza, same. The intro of Imagine Dragon's Dream builds as Jean walks up the plaza. Jean's POV. Two massive winged bronze statues stand like angelic sentinels over the plaza. Their black bases covered with note cards and dozens of photos of loved ones, lost ones, missing ones. On the star chart built into the plaza floor stand four burning candles next to four wheat bouquets, each adorned with a bright yellow desert wildflower, a fresh memorial. A few people stand near the angels looking at the photos. A hunter rubs the angel's feet, a good luck ritual before throwing on his pack and walking off into the night. The first verse begins. As we land on a woman, 40s, kneeling barefoot on a prayer rug, reciting the Isha prayer in Arabic.
Master of Day of Reckoning, you alone do we worship, and you alone do we ask for help for each and everything. Guide us on the straight path, the path of those who have bestowed your grace, not the path of those who have angered you, nor those who went astray. Amen.
The young man who helped Eli is kneeling a few yards from her, praying to a different god.
Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid, for the Lord Jehovah is my strength and my song. He also has become my salvation. Give me the strength to endure. Lead me on the way, Lord, and I am yours. Help me find my mother. I am yours, Lord. I miss my mom.
The last words fade as tears stream down his face. Jean is transfixed by the public-private moment. She pulls out Mira's vial and backs away as the music moves us to interior residence room, same. Stacks of books, a double bed, as cozy as concrete allows. Franklin enters, moves his notebook and pencil from the bed. First verse close and crescendos. But instead of writing, grabs a pillow, buries his head in it, and screams his lungs out. Exterior, the damn bridge, the damn wall, night. We crash to chorus over, Jean on the bridge, alone, gulping down the last drop of liquid in the vial. She hyperventilates, grips the railing, dropping the vial, which shatters against the dam far below. The wind whips around her haunted face as she looks up at the Hoover Dam bypass bridge. The chorus softens. We push out, 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 to a panorama of the dam, as seen from the Hoover Dam bypass bridge. The dot that is Jean diminishing to obscurity. Final, moving upwards to the moon, the final piano notes of the chorus fade as we match cut to exterior, desert sky, night. The moon in a pitch-black desert night. The music fades out. We descend upon exterior Mesa Crest Ridge night. Exterior Mesa Crest Ridge night. The alphas surround the strange heap of sand on the Erie Plateau, bracing themselves for a fight.
We traced five first, then four. Could it be a funeral ritual?
They're aliens.
Search the perimeter and circle back.
They do. Shui moves towards the sand pile, flexing her sword every now and then. Suddenly.
Got one.
The guys are with her in seconds. In the dark, they can make out a long, dark tentacle buried under the sand. Interior Tanner's residence room the damn night. Tanner holds up the beaker, studying it. It's still settled into its layers of texture. With a syringe, he sucks up the black mercury-like slime and drops it into a small glass slide. Charming roommate grunts in his sleep. Tanner unwraps his injured hand and squeezes a few drops of blood onto the glass slide, right on top of the mercury. He seals the slide with the top plate. Forced together under the glass, the mercury and blood squeeze their way around each other. Then slowly, right in front of his eyes, the liquid begins to swirl. Tanner looks on in stunned disbelief as, blop, it's transformed into a smooth, homogeneous black liquid with a bright fluorescent glow. Off Tanner's, oh my fucking god, face, he grabs slides, syringe, beaker, and leaps for the door. Interior classroom night. Julie sits cross-legged on Franklin's desk, looking over at George, who's in his regular seat further back in the room, sharpening his pencils with a small knife.
It was him. I know it was him.
Gets away with it, so yeah, probably.
Well, not anymore. Eli almost died. Too many people are dying. From now on, no one fucks with anyone without payback. Are you with me?
George, mid-carving, hesitates. He looks up at Julie. She jumps off the desk and gets right up in his face.
We either gotta stick together, or it's everyone for themselves. Which do you prefer, George?
Together.
It's time to teach him a lesson. No more of that greed stuff. Time to do what's necessary.
Off George, both frightened and excited.
What are we gonna do?
Interior tunnel, the damn same. Barlow jogs through the tunnel, shooting glances over his shoulder. Sweaty, scared, looking a shade of guilty conscience. Wham! He collides with Tanner, who's been looking at the content of his hands instead of the path in front of him.
Watch it!
You watch it!
Tanner recoils, terrified of Barlow. Much more than what seems reasonable. But right now, nothing is reasonable.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
He backs away, then turns and sprints away. Off Barlow. Surprise. Worry. Panic. He splits in the opposite direction. Interior tunnel, same. Tanner approaches a door up ahead. Interior situation room, same. Jessup sits alone in the dark, two assault rifles in front of him. He puts a beige cloth of the table and uncovers rifle parts for a third weapon. Boom, 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 boom! Aggressive raps on the door. Faster than lightning, Jessup snatches a rifle off the table and takes cover on the floor, his weapon aimed at the door. Exterior Mesa Crest Ridge night. Kendrick puts on a glove, grabs the mysterious dark tentacle and yanks it out of the sand using his full power. Damn, he's strong. Slowly, a body appears, but...
No dice.
They all ease up. Just a German shepherd.
What's a damn dog doing out here?
Think they killed it?
Toxic exposure, it seems. There are no wounds.
Tim and Shui continue this search. Interior situation room same. Boom, 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 on the door again.
Jane, it's me. Open up.
Gene, Jessup is tense, shaking, adrenaline spiked as beads of sweat emanate from his forehead. If someone said severe PTSD, we'd believe them. He takes two steadying breaths, moving to put the rifles back in the locker. With trembling hands, he quickly disassembles the unfinished rifle, rewraps it in fabric, and shoves it in his backpack. Boom, boom, boom.
Open the door, please!
Calm down, damn it, I'm coming.
Jessup wipes the sweat off his forehead and opens the door.
What the hell is all the fuss about?
I'm sorry, sir. I didn't know it was just you. Where's Jean? I thought she'd be here.
Interior residence room night. Jean enters looking drained. Franklin is in his bed with pen and notepad like nothing ever happened. He looks up.
How are you?
I'm good. You?
Good.
A moment. Franklin walks up to her and kisses her. Deeply. Jean kisses him back. It's totally normal. They stand there, arms around each other.
You're getting home late.
Debriefing the tower guards. Got your analysis done for the day?
Yeah, I did.
She squeezes him tighter. Maybe not totally normal today.
Well, everything is going to be fine.
Off Jean, not entirely sure whether or not she believes that. Her walkie crackles to life.
Jean. Jean, come in. We need you in the situation room.
She reluctantly breaks away and heads towards the walkie.
What is it, Hank?
Not on the air. You need to come now.
Off Jean's and Franklin's puzzled looks as they both cross to the door. Exterior Mesa Crest Ridge night.
Got one!
Again, the office surrounds something dark. This time, an obscured body of black, jello-like substance is sprawled in the sand. The team surrounds it. Suddenly, Christopher's tracker blinks red again in the same second. And in the same second, the alien body starts to writhe in the sand.
Shit, it's still alive!
In unison, they aim their blades at the dark one. Christopher inspects it. He sees its slimy surface is dry with only some blotchy patches left.
It's been tapped already.
Yeah, then how come it's still moving?
Interior situation room same. Jean and Franklin have now joined Tanner and Jessup looking grave.
What's so bad you couldn't tell me on the radio? It's a security system?
Just maintaining status quo.
Status quo doesn't exist anymore. Jean, I don't know what people would do if they found out.
Found out what?
I had a whim to test the properties in the alien jelly against my own blood.
Jean, instantly worried.
How?
Well, I had a welding accident.
Are you hurt?
No, but then I had this idea.
The point, Tanner.
Tanner picks up his beaker and his slide.
The blood and the jelly became one texture, one substance, and then this fluorescent reaction.
He holds up the slides, showing its lucid glow.
This cellular mutation shows an ability to fuse with human molecules on a biocompatible level.
Jessup wipes his forehead again.
It's like the blood and the jelly became one and the same. Do you know what that means? The Dark One's cells can merge with human cells.
Franklin's brow has a serious crease.
So you're saying...
They can become just like us.
Exterior Mesa Crest Ridge night.
No, that's impossible.
If it's tapped, it dies.
Not this one.
A beat. More unprecedented circumstances. They look at each other.
Well, let's change that.
She strides in, swings her samurai sword swiftly over the head. Zing! Smash two. Interior residence room same. Nadia jerks away, gasping, choking, her eyes flashing open in shock. But her corneas are lost behind the black mercury liquid, oozing from her tear ducts and out of her nose. She rolls off the cot, falls to her knees, and vomits up the same black liquid. She recovers, panting, drenched in sweat and black liquid. Pulling off her soiled shirt, we push in to see the veins of her skin turning all black with a bright fluorescent glow. Off Nadia's eyes, terrified, remembering everything, smashed to black.
Woo!
Woo! Wow, that ending! So many questions, Maria.
I don't want to wait. I know. Wow, what's going on?
Thank you again for such a wonderfully well-written script. Guys,
thank you.
Very well read. Tim, I'm learning you play children very well.
Yeah.
We had him playing a lot of kids last week. It was very good.
I love it. I was like, oh my god, I hear Julie. I hear her.
I have so many questions. Like, the first question I just have to ask you is, like, what are the Dark Ones? I don't know how much we're supposed to know, how much we do know. Can you talk a little bit about just that idea in the script? Because it's so mysterious to me.
Yes. So, the Dark Ones are really guardians of the Milky Way. And they have come to Earth because they saw we were ruining the Earth,
wow,
which is what we're doing. And they started shutting down the gas plants, the oil rigs, the nuclear plants. And, of course, we saw that as an act of war. And then we went to war with them. So, the opposite thing happened. Of course, we ruined the ecosystem instead. And so, they have attacked Nadia, which is what happens in the teaser.
Yeah.
And have literally, you know, infiltrated her body and have sent her in to this community to try and mediate between humans and aliens,
wow,
to save the planet.
Mm.
So
why do they want to save the planet?
They want to save the planet because they're basically guardians of the Milky Way, so anytime there's a planet in trouble, they go and try to fix it. Yeah, and so basically, as far as appearance goes, they're like kind of like cuttlefish, jellyfish, and they are consist of maybe 95% water, which is the reason why we can drink them after they've been filtered out. And because humans are 70% water as well, that's why they can merge. The cells can merge. So basically, we discover later on as she tries, you know, she, Nadia, has her own body and her own personality. And then anytime this fluorescent reaction happens, she feels these knees or these instincts pulling her in a specific reaction. So she, a specific direction. So she has to deal with both and try to navigate that kind of duality.
And she like blacks out when it happens.
Well, she kind of blacks out, and then she has to hide. She can't, you know, because you can see her veins turning black, and so there's this weird, like, on involuntary Spider-Man kind of, you know, morphing that's happening. But eventually, which is what happens about halfway through the first season, so we discover, the hunters discover a huge oasis in the desert with life and water and palm trees and fruit. And we find out that it's made by the aliens. And then, of course, when that happens, nothing goes well because that's just too good to be true.
Wow, I have so many more questions about this script. But before we get into that, I kind of want to know more about you. Are you a big sci-fi junkie, or?
You know, yes and no. I think I'm a big fantasy person. So I love high concept, and I love just stories that are unique, that are interesting, that have interesting characters and settings. And I'm very much like I love painting with a wide brush and flowery, you know, like in these gorgeous settings, landscape settings. So that's what I love as far as visuals. So it's not so much sci-fi as it is just, you know, like, I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan.
Yeah.
Major Lord of the Rings fan. Harry Potter, you know, things like that. It's, yeah, more fantasy than anything else.
Well, that comes through because while it's kind of veiled in a sci-fi lens, these kind of moralistic components and almost parable-like elements to the script start to ring as we go further, which I feel like are definitely a trope in fantasy. So yeah. I think those influences really ring in a beautiful way in the script.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. I love stories like this because, like, we've seen the aliens are the enemy narrative so many times.
Exactly.
And, like, the aliens might be here to help us narrative is so much more interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And it comes every once in a while. Arrival, I'm thinking of.
Did you see Arrival?
I hope you saw that movie. Oh, you need to see
it. I have it, and I still have not
seen
it.
You're going to love it.
I know. It's been on my list for the longest because I knew it was very similar in that way. And I think that's kind of the whole point, is that, you know, as that's the underlying theme through the story, is that we always, as humans, we always fear what we don't know. Which is also what we see in Nadia when she comes. You know, that she's a stranger. She's a human, but she's a stranger. She's not us. Mm-hmm. She's them.
Yeah.
The foreigners, the refugees, you know, because this is our country, Hoover Dam.
Right.
So it's like there's us and them, and that's within America and within, you know, the aliens and the humans. And I find it so wonderfully human and self-destructive that we always see danger and decide to be aggressive rather than look for opportunity.
It's so, I love that, and now more than ever that narrative really kind of resonates, I think. It was kind of chilling to watch Nadia come in after a 400-mile journey and be immediately put up for execution.
Yeah.
There's something so spooky about how that narrative parallels the alien narrative as well.
Yeah.
But Jessup was right, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, watch out for her.
Well, yeah. So that's the duality, because it's not just, you know, I like to tell stories that offer various perspectives. I don't like the lecturing kind. I don't like, you know, when we're trying to spoon feed some kind of narrative. So I want to make sure that we, you know, offer the whole perspective. I mean, granted, the aliens are also killing the humans because there's a war going on,
right?
Because they're defending themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it does, you know, Franklin does hint at the fact that there's no proof of them ever engaging, but they are defending themselves, right? So, of course, we're going to be like, well, yeah, they are killing us.
And they have a mission that they have to uphold.
They have a mission that they have to uphold, and that's why they're staying. That's why they haven't left, because they're on the planet to try and fix it. So now they're taking desperate measures, right?
Such a multifaceted... I interrupted you.
No, no, I was going to say, so I have a question, since I was reading Jessup, and he kind of seems like the antagonist in the beginning, but what I think is so cool about this pilot is that you're not telling us what to do, whereas in so many times when you watch pilots, it's like, these are the people you like, these are the people you don't like, right, and these are the ones you're going to be rooting for, and these are the people you're against.
Yeah.
What I think is so cool about this is that literally no one has anyone to latch on to other than what they might personally identify with. Mm-hmm. How did you decide to take that approach in writing a pilot? Because usually pilots are so dependent on latching onto one specific person.
Good versus evil.
Versus evil. This is so open for interpretation.
Well, my biggest thrust into the story is that everything needs to be real. Mm-hmm. Everything needs to feel real. These are real people. These are not, you know, like pretty actor people. They're real people. Mm-hmm. And in real, very real circumstances. I mean, when, of course, this is like the worst case scenario and, you know, there are aliens, but this is very much what the world could look like 100 years from now if we don't change what we're doing to the ecosystem. So it's very much rooted in that, and humans are, you know, complex, and humans are good and evil. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure that everybody, you know, Gene has a little issue, right, and Franklin runs around like acting like everything is good, but he's really, you know, deeply traumatized. Yeah. And, you know, Jessup, later his arc becomes, he is the antagonist in a way that he knows what he means, and he says what he means, and he's like, well, we got to do what we got to do to survive. Mm-hmm. So it comes from a place of survival. I got to protect these people.
Yeah, it's all everything is very just in his actions.
So in that sense, you know, I like these things where you can argue both sides of a case. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if you've guys seen Eye in the Sky with Helen Mirren this year, and it was such a great way of having arguing several sides of one argument. Mm-hmm. And I think like that's what The Courier does, you know. And all throughout the undertones, we have this, you know, like, now we've learned that we must save the planet, that we must take care of it, but within that, we have to deal with the consequences of our actions, and we have to survive. So it's, you know, I like to think of it that in America today, you know, we've almost lost our primal survival instincts because we've gotten so used to instant gratification. Mm-hmm. And I like, you know, I need my plastic water bottle because it's convenient. I need plastic, this, plastic, that. I need to irrigate my lawn to be green and these things. And it's, I call it throwing money into a slot machine knowing that you're going to lose. Mm-hmm. And it's so human. You know, we can't stop. We're greedy.
Yeah.
And what I want to walk away, or what I want people to walk away with when they've seen the show, is like, if you just have one thought in the morning when you're brushing your teeth, like, oh, I got to turn off the water while I brush my teeth. Mm-hmm. That is what makes the difference.
Wow.
That is when you just have one thought, like, oh, wait, water. Save the water. You know, if you go to Hoover Dam now, you can see this line is not, like, I didn't make that up. That is a thing already because there's so much water that's gone. Mm. And, you know, Americans use, in one day, America uses enough water to fill all of Lake Mead, which is the largest water reservoir in the United States.
Wow.
Just to irrigate their lawns. Like, in one day. So that's just to bring things in. And there's a drought in California. You know what I mean? Not anymore. But it's just to bring things into perspective. And it's so interesting that we see all these things happening, and yet we live in denial. And we don't want to deal with it because it makes things more difficult. So this is what will happen, and I like to explore that because I also love dark. I love dark stories. I love, you know, worst case scenario, or, you know, just we're human, we are flawed beings, and we have something really dark fueling us, and I like to explore that realm.
Probably the most interesting part for me was the generational aspect of it. So just alone, I was reading a 15-year-old and a 60-year-old, and then there were people of all ages in between. But I love that moment where it was like, you mean your generation did this?
Yeah, like
you
guys did this. Baby
yeah, and exactly.
We keep being like people make jokes all the time. They're going to be like, oh, in 100 years, like our grandkids, kids are going to be fucked or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is.
But it's true.
But it is. And at some point, mm-hmm. the kids are going to outsmart the parents and be like, look at what you guys did.
Exactly.
Like, and they're going to look up and be like, you did this.
And I feel like it's sort of already happening. I think there's a younger, very conscientious generation that is emerging because of everything that's going on in the world right now. And that's why I specifically made the choice that this is 16 years after the exposure, which is the climate collapse, so that you have the 30-year-olds and over knowing the old world, and then you have anybody who's younger only growing up in this fight or flight, primal survival, you know, save the planet. Mm-hmm. So there you have those both aspects. And then I just find it interesting that it's the kids that are these, like, gritty, you know what I mean, that this is the world now.
They know how to survive more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about that on Walking Dead all the time with the baby being born into that world. It's just like what she knows.
Yeah.
So I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan. My favorite line of this whole pilot is, it takes courage to hope.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you had any pull from the speech that Sam gave at the end of Two Towers.
No, it's so funny that you say that, but no, actually. But good. good call.
Hope is such a driving factor in that whole trilogy and in this pilot that I was just curious.
Yeah, because I feel like if we just look at humanity and our evolution up to this point, we have started regressing.
Yeah.
And with everything that's going on in the world right now, I feel like it's everything in me not to, like, wake up in the morning and just, like, what the fuck? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I find that the only way that you can get through the day is to hope. Mm-hmm. So I have a saying that says, you know, you got to be cynical enough to know that there is a problem in the world and naive enough to think you can make a difference.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's what I like to, that's the stories I like to tell. Conscientious stories. Stories that matter. Stories that impact you, that makes you reflect on society today. You know, that's very much my lane. Cool. Yeah.
I'm always interested in structure because I'm a writer as well.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like socially progressive content is very important to you. Do you kind of approach your narrative knowing the social beats you want to hit and then design characters around that? Or I'd like to hear how you developed this pilot specifically.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because it was weird. It came out in a weird way. Usually I just have an idea and I pitch it to myself. I'm like, this would be a cool idea. Yeah. And then I go from there.
Mm-hmm.
But this one was because I was working in Vegas and I had 2 days off. And I was like, I can't have 2 days off. So I need to go shoot something. Because I'm also an actor. And then I was like, what can I shoot in Vegas? And I went out with a friend. We went to Valley of Fire and just started shooting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then this tale was born of, you know, post-apocalypse and what happened and how did they get here and who's this woman and et cetera, et cetera. And so it was built off of that. And I was originally going to shoot and produce a concept teaser for the show.
Huh.
And then a friend was like, no, you should just write the whole pilot, you know?
Yeah.
And so I did. And I did the whole Bible and everything because the more I looked into it, the more the story just developed. And then but it always comes from a place because that's just how I'm wired, that it comes from a place of, you know, social awareness. But then you find these characters. Because I'm an actor, I love characters, you know?
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
You're our first writer-actor in studio, really, who would kind of identify themselves as someone who is kind of splits the line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How does you being an actor influence your writing?
Oh, fully.
Yeah.
Fully, because I know what turns me on when I'm an actor reading a script. You know, I know, like, when I write my character breakdowns, like, how what I want to read and how that can influence what I'm, like, how I'm going to play a part. So I very much try to leave a lot of, you know, you see in the pilot, there's a lot of look off of, you know, because it's all the actors' reactions.
Yeah.
I find that visual storytelling, I'm not Aaron Sorkin, so, like, I love the visual storytelling.
Uh-huh.
Like, we want to see it all.
Mm-hmm.
It's less in the words than it is in the actors' expressions and performances. And because I'm an actor, because I love acting, and because I love great characters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I try to develop these very strong, very unique characters throughout. And then, you know, I wanted the strong women. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted the women, and I wanted the diversity, because this Hoover Dam community really represents and reflects what America looks like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And which is, we're still, you know, trying to level out on TV today, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't represent what America looks like, and I wanted this pilot to do that.
Yeah, that's one thing I definitely noticed with your characters, once you said you were an actress, was that, like, there's not one character in this entire pilot that isn't interesting, or it feels like they're just in there for, like, oh, yeah, your coffee's right over here, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like there's none of those useless roles in here. I feel like almost every single character, there could be a whole backstory on
yeah,
you
even
follow.
young
yeah.
man who
yeah, that's so much
like,
yeah.
like
yeah.
even the
yeah.
roommate who's kind yeah. of a jackass. He's like the most, like, I guess, filler character.
Yeah.
Even that guy,
yeah.
you put in that thing that he grunts in his sleep, and that's mm-hmm. just enough to be like, yeah, that guy's a real person.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, in a way. I mean, and honestly, you know, I did think of it that way. Like, yeah, they have to live. That was a way of showing, you know, the tight quarters mm-hmm. that they all have to, like, mm-hmm. the claustrophobia and the dealing with other people in your space and just getting along. Because can we all just not get along, you know, in America right now? And I think, but the roommate also, you know, they're all lonely. They're all traumatized. They're all, like, just have to try and exist. And so you kind of just have to, like, be the bigger person a lot and mm-hmm. deal with other people's crap.
Yeah.
So yeah, he does have, you know, he does have a life to me, you know. I could go on.
I'm wondering, of the three, like, the three kind of ABC, so we have the classroom, we have, like, Gene and Hank, and mm-hmm. then we have the alphas.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite to write? I don't know, that's hard to pick. I know that's a
yeah,
mean question to ask a writer sometimes.
That's difficult. I really love writing for Franklin, uh-huh. because Franklin is so smart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's literally, like, the guy who's got everything figured out. Like, come on, people, get on my level,
yeah.
get it. and then, you know, even Gene, which I kind of love, that they're at odds, but they're a couple.
Yeah,
right?
That was a great reveal. That might be my favorite reveal in the whole
yeah.
pilot.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I don't, and people are like, why did that need to be a reveal? I'm like, because it just did.
Yeah. It works. I think you should play it the way you did.
Yeah. When did you start writing this? Because I see the date of the master draft, which was the end of last year. When did this start? Because something about it I want to ask you about.
I started writing this pilot exactly a year ago. Well, no. I started developing the show. I went to shoot in Vegas exactly a year ago, because it just came up on my Facebook.
So we talked about how the younger generation, it seems like Franklin has kind of taken the reins of the older guy with the younger generation. And I don't know if you meant it, but it was Bernie Sanders to me, and that how the young people have just grown to him, and he is the older guy going, we've screwed everything up, and he's fighting for the little guy.
Yeah.
And I see that, and I don't know if it was because it was in our zeitgeist of the
yeah,
year.
Yeah, that's
but
so
it's,
funny. No, I love that. But no,
that's him. He's this older
so
guy
cool.
that the young generation, the millennials, have gone to.
Yeah.
To the guy, this he sees we've, yeah. the older people, we messed up.
Yeah.
And the younger people, and he's kind of their champion. I see that with Franklin. And then you've got, you know, just with the military, and it's
mm-hmm.
this wonderful... One of the, I think for me, best sci-fi shows is Battlestar Galactica, the remake, where
mm-hmm.
it was like theological versus the military, and you've got the military versus this whole...
Yeah, the intellectuals.
Yeah.
So that's what it was. It was very much like how intellectualism is somehow, you know, oh, the intellectuals and the elitists
yeah.
and, you know... Oh, these people, they think they know better.
Yeah.
And Franklin is like, but don't you see what's going on? You know,
yeah.
and that's why he's so excited when Nadia comes, like, oh my God, she's another, you know, scientist who sees who is progressive
mm-hmm.
and is, you know, evolutionary in her botany work. And of course, eventually things
yeah.
get... You
They're
know.
A better couple, for sure.
Yeah.
So last year, that was kind of a common thing, because there was this kind of... I don't know. I like... I'm from a family of nerds who are always having very intellectual science conversations when I'm home. But there was a big, like, uprising of last year, of a lot, especially on Facebook and just in social media, of people being like... Intellectuals coming out and being like, this is not good. Like, please... Please don't make this man president. Please don't do this. Like
yeah.
this could be really bad, you guys. And so
yeah.
that kind of is reflected of, like, well, this is... I feel like for the Courier, it's kind of like a prophecy and a warning at the same time of, like, maybe don't...
Yeah,
don't go in this direction.
Yeah, I mean, that. Hopefully, that is kind of the idea. It's just awareness, in a sense. And also, on a much more... hands-on, pragmatic scale, the show includes real technology for, mm-hmm. you know, so we have desert irrigation, we have the solar panels, mm-hmm. the dam is 100% self-sustainable. You know, they are learning, like, they have to learn how to farm again,
yeah.
you know, desert farming. And so Tanner invents these drones that are going to be, like, irrigating the little desert crop that they have. Mm-hmm. Water, you know, solar desalination is mm-hmm. a real technology mm-hmm. that it's free. You know, yeah. you can literally make it for free, and no one wants to do that because, of course, you can't make money off of
it. But
there's
illegal.
Yeah, there's so many people, there's so many places where this is necessary. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of salt water, and there are people dying every day yeah. of lack of water. So, you know, these things are, I really want to implement. Like, these are real technologies that could be implemented in society all over the world that are important, you know, that we should highlight. Mm-hmm. So that's very much, you know, a part of it, too. Like, we talk about the environment, but it's more so, like, this is how you need to get by in the mm-hmm. world at this time.
Are you going to also play into just, in terms of, we're 16 years past, but in terms of government play into the fight with the Dark Ones and the war that was set up and how
yeah.
that kind of...
So the government, I mean, because of the way the country works and it's this dystopic, you know, we don't have cell phones operating mm-hmm. the same way because the country is ruined very mm-hmm. much and so many people have died. So they kind of have their own little...
But I meant prior, before we get to, is there ever going to be like how they got to this place,
like
type flashbacks? Of episode, flashback? Or
I try to shy away from flashbacks. Mm-hmm. It's like a thing that I've decided.
A lot
I think,
of people don't like them.
I it's think that's like I remember David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, they're talking about Game of Thrones. They're like, we just didn't want to use flashbacks. And I kind of feel that way too, mm-hmm, yeah. only because it's a little sometimes is like a easy out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. As far as narrative, you know, as a writer, I'm like, okay, I'll make it a little bit harder for myself, but how can I shape this world without having to, like, mm-hmm. oh, by the way, this is what I meant. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So yes, there will be ways of going into the exposure and into how the world came to be this way mm-hmm. with, you know, Petronius, the Petronius platform, which mm-hmm. is a real oil rig in the Mexican Gulf of Mexico, mm. And how that went up in flames, and that was essentially what the catalyst for the exposure.
Okay. Well, I think the imagery you use to paint that is so much cooler than going and showing us. Being like 180 degrees in Mexico, thousands yeah. dead. In my mind, I see some really fucked up stuff.
Yeah.
So I think
yeah.
that leaves
yeah,
it open
that
for
was...
interpretation.
And the scary part about it is that last year, 160 degrees were recorded
wow.
in Iraq.
Like,
in Iran.
That's yeah. like
so
a sauna.
It's not that far off.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? Of course, 160 degrees, not real temperatures, but like wind.
Yeah.
Wind gusts or whatever, but still, you know, it's not that far. Seattle's reservoir is already disappearing. Mm-hmm. The permafrost in Greenland is already disappearing,
wow.
and all the storms we've had, like, this isn't sci-fi.
It's
yeah,
real, you guys.
Yeah, that's what the most haunting scene for me was just those newspaper headlines.
Yeah.
That's what stuck with me since I read it the other day, because that doesn't feel like science fiction, because it's not. It's
yeah.
just
yeah.
the future.
I did incorporate it, which is a show about climate change. I was like, anytime I watch any show that's a fictional setup of climate change, I'm like, this is not fiction. This is just a prediction of like 60 years from now.
Yeah, yeah. That's what's a bit scary. I mean, literally, it's the biggest problem we have right now. And because, you know, if there's no Earth to live on, how can we all be mad at each other? You know, we don't have a place to exist.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I find it completely vital that we need to address these things, or not necessarily, you know, because it gets so tiring to always be arguing about mm-hmm. these things in the political space. So I find that this a good narrative drama is a way to promote this awareness without boring people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, it's a subconscious influence. That thing, when you've seen this pilot, you may want to look into it. You may start Googling Hoover Dam, what that looks like, what it looked like mm. in the 80s with the water levels. Mm. And maybe just that thing about, oh, turn off the water.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
close the fridge. Turn off your lights. Don't leave the TV on. Like, just little mm. things like that. Don't need that much meat. You know?
Yeah.
That tiny, tiny things. And people are always like, I have a friend, I was like, well, what is my water bottle going to do? If I save one water bottle, that's not going to make a difference. Well, the problem is if everybody thinks that way, nothing is ever going to... Yeah. We're never going to make a difference. If anybody just saves one water bottle, you know, there's like, what, 250 million people in America?
Look how amazing our mugs are.
Yeah, I love it.
I like that you brought up the question about flashbacks and history, because I think in a world-building pilot like this, establishing history can be a challenge for writers. Mm-hmm. And Andrew brought up the point that you did it so visually, which I think is a testament to both your instincts as a writer and just, I think it's a good piece of advice for writers if you're trying to incorporate history, things like, you know, newspaper clippings or, you know, like a lecturing professor are a great way to... kind of seamlessly incorporate world building.
Mm-hmm.
Along those lines, I'm wondering if you have other advice for pilot or for writers who listen to this show, because this is kind of our first time reading a socially conscious kind of a moody sci-fi piece. So any like rules that you follow specifically as a writer or advice that you would offer?
Well, I can do a little plug for the Script Notes podcast and the Children of Tendu podcast. I listen to those a lot. Mm-hmm. They're a great, great, great podcast and so much valuable information. Other than that, I just... You know, I'm an actor. I've read a lot of pilots.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of pilots.
Yeah.
So that helps. You know, just reading the scripts and reading structure.
Yeah.
And then... writing, you know, this is my first script.
Wow.
You know, so, and then
damn
I just,
it.
My first full script, I've written other things, but this is my first full pilot script.
Nice.
And then I just finished a second one, which is also, is different, but in the same conscientious vein.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, you gotta go with your instinct.
Yeah.
And I, like, my tone is very much raw, gritty, visual, and I'm just realizing, okay, I should be owning this because this is what I'm good at, you know? Mm-hmm. And I write the characters that I would like to play, and I write the shows that I want to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I see the movie, and I see the show unfold, and I'm like, okay. And then I write what I'm seeing in my head.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. I'm a fan of the shows that I write. Because otherwise, how can I write them, right?
I love that.
Yeah. So that's mostly
speaking of playing one of the roles that you've written, which role in this would you want to play?
What do you think?
Nadia.
Yeah.
Yep. I can't. It's funny, because we only get kind of specs of Nadia here, but she's the courier.
She is the courier. Yes.
It's so exciting to like imagine her trajectory for the rest of the show.
Yeah, it's going to be a wild, wild ride.
Yeah.
And hope and despair battles daily for these people.
Yeah.
Mm. That's kind of how I feel like what we're doing every day now.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I have some questions about the future of the script, but before we move on to that, any questions specifically about the pilot we read today that you guys had?
Just one quick question about the aliens, because you had said earlier that they merge with human biology, and I noticed, and one of my favorite parts in the script was the dog in the beginning, and then there's another dog at the end. Was that the same dog? Can they manipulate other species as
that's
well?
That's why he says just a German shepherd is like, oh, they're where she was attacked.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's where they've come.
Right.
And so that alien that is lying in the sand is the one that merged with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why it's still kind of alive, and like, this has never happened before. I'm like, no, because it just went into her body. You know, it took all of its liquid out of its own body and put it in her body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still lying there, and that's why they did this whole thing, like they were trying to save it, and then of course they couldn't, so like they left it there and they were off. Yeah. But I did have one note. It was so interesting when you were reading Tony the voiceover or the off screen. So I wrote her as a real person. But I felt like you...
A little AI-y to
me. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And I thought that was so interesting. Yeah, I was like, oh, that works.
So I watched Legends of Tomorrow. It's a CW show with Gideon, who is the person in the ship. And she actually recently just came to life. But she still had like an AI voice. So I was like, even I saw in your things, it was like, she might never be shown.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, maybe she... Yeah. I don't know.
Or like a Jarvis.
Jarvis, right. So like, not too choppy, but a little... I
kind of like that. I was like, ooh, that could be interesting.
Was there other things about when we were reading it that you did or didn't like, or that worked or did not?
There were things. It's just so lovely to hear. I loved the sequence, by the way. That was different, but the dream, like, because I've never, you know, I've heard it, but like, I really loved that moment. And then a lot of the I found that a lot of the dialogue did work, like, really well, mm-hmm. and that I felt the characters, you know, have the opinions that they should be having. My only note was with Jean, because she's a difficult human being, you know, mm-hmm. she's, like, very...
Prickly?
Yeah, and she's just, you know, detached mm-hmm. a lot, mm-hmm. but she has this inner fire in her, yeah. so she's, like... She's more intense. I think that was my only note. Like, she's an intense person.
I was like, she's a hard person to read. Because she it's is. Something that when she you is. Get to actually be active with her, yeah. and it's yeah. a lot of what she doesn't say. Yeah. So, like, sitting here, yes. I was like, this is going to sound weird. I was like, but she's definitely somebody, like, everything she says isn't what she doesn't say.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you did so. Completely, yeah. completely. So, completely. It's exactly that. Everything is, she's... It's all that's going on underneath her, you know. Mm-hmm. She's like 1 second away from just exploding into yeah. a ball of fire. So because of all this pain, so that is also you find out later. Franklin and Jean had a son,
yeah.
that died. Or, so you know that from the breakdown, but mm-hmm. anybody who reads the script doesn't know that. They had a son that died in Earth War, and because of that, of course, when Eli is almost dying, that is like, oh, this can't happen again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and that's why she has that maternal moment with him as well. Later. And why they also stand there and, like, hug each other a little bit longer than usual. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm always curious, like, where you might see this living on TV. I'm assuming premium cable, probably.
Yeah. HBO, Netflix, Amazon. Yeah. It's a very... It's gritty, mm-hmm. you know. I need it to be raw. I need it to feel lived in. I need it to have the pace for a full hour. Mm-hmm. You know, it could go with commercial breaks, but for me, even now, like, we read it pretty fast. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more like we need that time for the to catch the reactions. Mm-hmm. We need that beat, because that beat tells me how I feel about that thing that you're talking about, right? So I definitely would rather see it on a full hour mm-hmm. Station, HBO for sure, and Netflix. Like, those are my top bids for this.
It's interesting, because I agree with you, but then part of me thought, like, a couple small changes and I almost could see this on CW. That network has changed so much.
Yeah, like the 100 kind
of. Like the 100.
A lot of people have said sci-fi too.
Or sci-fi.
But I find, like, I love a lot of stuff that sci-fi is doing. It's just a matter of, like, I almost would rather go towards, like, National Geographic or History Channel. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because of the nature of the awareness and the cause and the fact themes. That everything is based in facts,
mm-hmm. yeah.
You know, technological facts and everything that's going on right now. So in that sense, maybe in that realm, because mm-hmm. it just feels more real. It's like a sci-fi documentary, but told with the visuals of a feature film.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe then, like, A&E. Because A&E used to be a historical television show. Now they have Bates Motel, and so I think a little bit more.
I totally saw an FX or an AMC.
That's AMC for sure.
Yeah.
Do you watch the show? I think it's Discovery Channel. It's called Mars.
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about? Yeah.
Yes,
that would
exactly.
be where it's real scientists, but then they kind of jump to the future, which probably it's all science-based.
Yeah.
And that's so new. It's like...
Yeah, I actually know that show really well. And it was... The only difference is, of course, that is real documentary mixed with, and that's, I think now that's becoming a new genre. There's a lot of shows that are developed that way. But because I love narrative, and because, you know, I love storytelling, and I love coming up with new stuff, I think, you know, narrative fiction is a way for us to deal with everything that's going on in the world without being, like... choked by it, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. When you watch documentaries about climate change and about, you know, the war in Syria and about politics, you just get so depressed.
Yeah.
So it's a way of, you know, again, of permeating people's minds with these ideas and maybe self-reflection and what can I do differently? And like, this is where we're at in this world. So. What would I actually be willing to do? Because that's mm-hmm. the whole point, is that, you know, we know this is coming. We see it coming. And we know that certain things are bad. But are we really willing to change our ways mm-hmm. to actually make that difference.
Or give a dying boy water.
Yeah, that's another. Yeah, so yeah. That and that really tells you, like, oh, this is the world that you're in. Like, water is precious.
Yeah.
Water is gold, you know, and that is also what's happening now. People are starting to invest in you know, water and it's interesting times. Yeah, so yeah, absolutely. I think in that realm, I think Mars is. I did. In a different conversation talks, I'm like, this is what I mean. but we'll see. I mean, as long as it's just that rawness and that grittiness and that realness is what I thought would be interesting to bring to a sci-fi show, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, we can't thank you enough, Maria. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, oh my God, I love this. Thank you so much. Yeah, this was amazing.
Such a beautifully written pilot, and it's such a subtle but urgent way to incorporate such important social theme. Yeah. So I'm glad you read this. Guys, if you liked the show today, I would recommend listening to our first episode, Accelerator. It's got some of the same kind of engineering components that Tim's character Tanner kind of touched on. Also, our third episode, we read a sci-fi drama called Sawyer that also talked about sort of the ambiguous motivations of extraterrestrial life. So I think that'd be another great one to listen to. Mm-hmm. And also, I need to thank ARA Printing on Magnolia Boulevard. They print these scripts for us for free, which is so great. So we really encourage you, writers, Maria, for example. It's by far the best place in town to get scripts printed. Like, double-sided features end up costing, like, $5, which compared to, like, Kinko's or anywhere else is probably three times the cost.
I do my own table reads, so I'll definitely keep that.
Yeah, absolutely. ARA Printing.
And they bind them for you and everything.
Yes.
And don't we have a code?
And we have a promo code if you go. So if you need to get stuff printed,
okay.
Anyone who's listening, you included.
Yes.
go to ARA Printing on Magnolia, 5 minutes from here. Promo code table read, you get 10% off of your order.
Nice.
So yeah. In the meantime, guys, this is the Popcorn Talk Network. If you're listening to our podcast, you can also be watching us on the Popcorn Talk Network.com. It's PopcornTalkNetwork.com.
Yep.
And YouTube.
And we'd love it. If you're listening, please rate, like, and subscribe. We'd love to get some comments. Mm-hmm. I'm just so curious as to what you guys think. But yeah. As always, we have more shows. If you like this show, Haley's on a show called Sci-Fi Weekly, which is on Sundays.
That's right.
so yeah, that was the show, and we're so thankful that you guys could be with us today. Again, this is the unproduced table read on the Popcorn.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Jeff. Happy birthday to
oh my God, and you can sing.
It's my birthday.
Happy birthday.
But thank you guys. That's the show. Guys, thank you so much. Before we go, let everyone know where they can find you guys.
I'm Andrew Guy. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Andrew Guy. You can also find me here every Wednesday at 12:30 for Action Movie Anatomy.
All right, I'm Adrienne Snow. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Miss Adrienne Snow. You can also see me on AfterBuzz for The Magicians After Show, occasionally on Legion. And that's it right now.
Hi, I'm Mike Konosky. Find me at Mike Konosky on social media. I'm on the Popcorn Talk Network with Miss Roxy Stryer for DC movie news and my very own character corner. Also, AfterBuzz, MacGyver, Taken, Iron Fist, and Badlands coming up.
Jesus.
So I'm going crazy with the action stuff.
Hey-o.
I'm Haley O'Connor on Twitter at Haley O'Connor, and Jeff already plugged for me. I'm on Sci-Fi Weekly on the Popcorn Talk Network on Sunday afternoon.
Hey, everybody. I'm Timothy Michael. You can find me on all social media platforms at I am Timothy Mike, and I'm going to be over at AfterBuzz Monday night, with Quantico coming back from our 3-week break. And then Twyla.
I'm Roxy Stryer. You can find me everywhere at Roxy Stryer, and I'll tell you what I'm doing there.
Maria, where can they find you? Any executives who want to buy your script?
MariaStan.com is my website. We've got an acting section. We've got a script section with all the, because I'm a producer as well, with all the projects I have in development. Three shorts and a feature. And I just finished writing a second pilot, which is a black western about runaway slaves who become spies for the Union Army.
Oh. Damn.
Get at me.
Come back.
Over to mariastan.com under scripts, and you'll find lots of different stuff over there that I'm working on.
That's great. Awesome.
I'm about to release a new film actually next week.
Awesome. Yeah. Great, we're looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I'm Jeff Graham. Thanks again for tuning in. You can find me on Twitter, Jeffrey C. Graham. If you have a script you want to pitch, you can reach me there. And that's the show. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.
Happy birthday, Jeff.
Thank you.
Christian Harloff and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.